This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Coming up today, melt-resistant ice cream, Google's sexy new logo, fishing with drones, and the latest from the IFA Technology Show in Berlin. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and also on the show today, we've got Daniel Colburn and the newest member of the Wired UK team, Cara McGugan. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Now, Cara, you've joined us from New York, is that right?
That is right.
How's the jet lag?
It's going all right so far.
You arrived in the UK on Sunday?
I did, and then I started on Tuesday. Thanks for the bank holiday weekend.
The office is a little quiet this week.
It's very quiet, yes, with Michael off in IFA.
Michael and Katie are off at IFA, and Michael's going to be reporting live / pre-recorded from IFA later in the show with all the latest shiny things. But to start off, we'll get on with the more pressing news of melt-resistant ice cream. Cara, what's the deal with this?
So this week, we saw the discovery of melt-proof ice cream. Researchers in Scotland made this using a protein called BSLA. This protein naturally occurs as a protective coat around communities of friendly plant growth bacteria. Doesn't sound great for your ice cream, but the researchers found it could keep oil and water solutions mixed, which is notoriously hard, and can also stop air bubbles from popping and coat surfaces nicely.
And all of this is very important to making ice cream delicious and solid.
Yeah, so you want it to be fluffy, you want your oil and your water to stay mixed, and you don't want any ice crystals, which this can do.
So it keeps the ice cream creamy.
That is right, just like the expensive ice creams on the market.
There you go.
I do wonder, I'm a huge ice cream fanatic, but do the flavours, I mean, do they have normal flavours or are they quite bizarre?
Well, so far they've only made it in the lab with their homemade ice cream makers. But they're going to sell it out to, or no, that's wrong. Can I go? They're hoping to form a partnership with an ice cream brand who will then develop flavours and will hopefully see it on the shelves in about 3 years.
So what's the point in this?
Well, obviously it's always really hot in England in the summer.
As we've seen, yeah.
Yeah, well, I missed that this year. But it's, to stop your cones from going soggy and your ice cream from melting all over your hands.
Now, apparently there is nothing worse than ice cream dripping down the cone when you're trying to eat it. I mean, I don't mind it. I don't have a problem. Sticky fingers, not a fan?
No. I'm very happy with this this invention.
So as Wired's resident ice cream fanatic, this is good news for you.
Smiles all around for me, yes.
But it's not going to happen for a few more years. 3 more years, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
So ice cream will remain melty and dripping all over your ice cream cone and your hands for a little while yet.
Yeah, so best to stick to the waffle cone.
That's top advice. Good advice, Daniel?
I'm all for it, definitely. Haagen-Dazs waffle cones.
Other ice cream brands are available. Okay, so from ice creams to the ingenious and downright weird use of drones. Daniel, this week we reported on someone that had gone fishing with their drone. Tell
yes.
us some more.
Now, obviously the drone kind of takeover seems imminent with all these bizarre stories in the news lately, but this may be the strangest yet. A farmer in Kansas, who goes by the name of Derek Klingenberg, I hope I've got that right, filmed himself using a drone to catch a fish before immortalizing the whole experience with a Snapchat photo.
So he's a true viral sensation farmer, this guy.
There's a bit of a story. He scored a few million YouTube hits for serenading his herd of cattle with trombone renditions of pop songs.
That sounds nice.
So he has a bit of a history of this kind of these antics. But basically, he used a DJI Phantom 2 quadcopter, which was armed with a camera and a fishing line, to hover over a lake on his farm and caught a small bluegill fish. Which apparently took 10 minutes.
And it is quite a small fish.
Yes. I mean, obviously, head over to wired.co.uk to watch the video, but it's a rather large drone catching a rather tiny fish. So slightly underwhelming, but it seems to be doing well on social media.
But this isn't the only weird use of drones that we've seen. A couple of months ago, a student for a high school project attached a gun to a homemade quadcopter and fired it in a woodland in the States.
Yes, slightly more nefarious uses. But yeah, basically an 18-year-old, strapped a gun to a drone and used it as a kind of flying handgun. No one was hurt, but obviously this raised a lot of questions about the legality of what you can actually use drones for.
And this gets people really excited. 2.8 million, maybe more by now, people watched that video of a drone firing a gun in the woods.
Yeah, it's quite something to watch. And it actually turned out he was Austin Horwout, I think you pronounce his surname, was actually arrested, but not actually for taking the video. It turned out he got into some kind of physical altercation with police after an investigation was launched into how legal strapping a gun to a drone can be.
And the police explained that they didn't actually know if there was a specific law to ban guns being attached to drones and fired.
Which is kind of terrifying.
It's this new legal grey area where people's playing around with technology is getting ahead of the law, which is quite strange.
It almost seemed obvious that putting a gun on a drone shouldn't be legal, but this is America, so, you know,
it's open to interpretation. Have you ever flown a drone, Cara?
I haven't, no.
Do they appeal to you? Do you think they look like fun things, or...?
Well, I would quite like to take some video footage using a drone. I think that would be fun.
You wouldn't be tempted to go fishing, though.
Depends what sort of fish I could catch.
Well, in this case, it really was one about the size of your hand. It was
it
pretty
be worth the effort.
Tiddly. And Daniel, as well as scouting around for interesting drone stories this week, you've also reported on a anti-drone laser that's been developed.
Yes. So if all this kind of drone antics get too much, there's also the possibility of destroying them completely, which might be quite nice to know for some people. Boeing has basically unveiled the latest version of its laser-powered anti-drone technology, which is called the Compact Laser Weapon System.
It's not a very good name. I mean, it's descriptive, but it doesn't sound terrifying enough.
Yes.
You think it would have a terrifying acronym?
Its predecessor, the High Energy Laser Mobile Demonstrator, had the acronym HEL-MD.
Now that's it.
That's slightly more fitting, yes. But basically the new version is a portable tripod-mounted device which is armed with a highly powerful laser that can burn a hole in a UAV in a mere matter of minutes.
It sounds terrifying.
Well, yes, drones should be scared. It's operated with an Xbox controller and a laptop and can fit into four suitcase-sized boxes. So if you'd like to kind of take it with you internationally on a bit of kind of drone destroying, then it's possible. But not for the next 2 years. Boeing is still in the process of testing the laser, so we probably won't see it for a little while yet.
I suppose the idea is once you bought the thing, it's really, really cheap to use, and because it's a laser, you don't ever have to refill the ammo. So you can go and destroy as many drones as you want.
Yep, as long as the battery has enough battery, it's got an unlimited magazine, and yeah, it's a lot more affordable than kind of previous versions.
But the technology isn't as perfect as it sounds. Fog can get in the way of your drone killing.
Yes, and dust as well. There have been kind of previous versions haven't quite lived up to the hopes, and they've not actually stayed in the air that long. So, yes, it's all still a bit questionable at this point.
And it would be used, I suppose, by maybe police forces. Airports have a lot of problems with drones flying over flight paths, so they could potentially use it.
Yes, Boeing have said they don't yet want to use it on the battlefield. It's more a case of getting rid of drones that might be hovering over kind of sensitive areas. Airports, kind of government buildings, that kind of thing.
So when you go and take pictures with your drone, Cara, don't fly it over a sensitive area or Boeing might shoot it down with a massive laser.
Then I could shoot it back with some guns.
You could, or try and go fishing.
And so from filming with drones, James, you've got a story this week about a VR film about Ebola.
Yeah, so when you say VR or virtual reality, most people will probably think about gaming. We've got a lot of big companies trying to make a lot of money out of virtual reality gaming in the next few months with the likes of Oculus, HTC Vive, and Sony's Project Morpheus. But early experiments in VR filmmaking are arguably way more compelling. This new film called Waves of Grace is a VR film from an Los Angeles-based production company called Verse, and it tells the haunting story of an Ebola survivor in Liberia. The film was launched this week, and I interviewed the studio co-founder Patrick Millen-Smith about the project, and it's absolutely amazing. If you're not particularly convinced about virtual reality, the difference between watching this film and watching a normal film about a subject like Ebola or the refugee crisis, which they've also done a film on, is so different. It's way, way more compelling. It's been produced in conjunction with the United Nations, and the hope is that by using VR, they can bring the horrors of these really, really big humanitarian issues closer to the policymakers and politicians who are often quite far removed from it. So they showed a film about the refugee crisis in Syria at Davos in January earlier this year, and it was shown to some of the world's most influential people. And the idea is that it will do more than photographs or video ever could.
And so what are the challenges of creating a film in VR?
So there was a few months between The Clouds Over Sidra, which was the Syrian refugee film, and Waves of Grace, the film about Ebola in Liberia. And when Patrick was explaining the technology to me, he said that the real challenge is working out how to film in VR, because it's really different to filming in non-VR. So you've got to think about how close people get to the camera and the sort of situations that you put the VR camera into. So in the film about Ebola, everything's much closer to you. You often stand on the precipice of things. So when you turn around, you're suddenly on a cliff edge or the side of a building, or at one point by the side of a freshly dug grave. And also having almost shocking reveals, so that when you turn around, there's something behind you that is completely unexpected.
I'm quite curious. This technology sounds like it's obviously makes for a very vivid experience, but I wonder, is there a risk that this could kind of sensationalize these kind of serious subjects like Ebola, or does it actually have a genuine kind of emotionally affecting impact as you're watching it? You actually feel like you're there.
I think it tells the story in a different way, right? So it's a different way of storytelling. So it puts you as a person in that situation, and you almost feel a bit like an outsider that doesn't belong there, because obviously the camera looks quite unusual, and the people in Liberia and in the refugee camp in Jordan are looking at you thinking, and they'll run up to you and stare at you, and you'll be it's strange.
Yeah,
it's quite an odd feeling.
Quite an unnerving, disconcerting, given the subject matter to be right in the center of these scenes.
Yeah, and it's very, very different to an awful lot of the uses of virtual reality that we've already seen, and the ones that are getting most of the headlines, the big companies making the big gaming headsets that are going to make an awful lot of money. But maybe this is a more interesting way of approaching virtual reality.
And so will this be widely available for the public, or is it mostly just for policymakers?
That's the thing that I like about it best. So as well as it being shown at UN conferences and to policymakers and politicians, you can also go and download it and watch it for yourself. It's free of charge. There's an app, but it's called Verse. It's available for Android and iOS. And you can watch the film in virtual reality if you've got a Google Cardboard, which is cheap and easy to get, or Samsung's Gear VR, which is a bit more expensive. But you can also watch it without a VR headset. You can stand and hold your phone and just turn around with it and explore the scenes, which is a little less immersive, but still pretty fantastic.
And do Verse have any plans for any future films, similar subjects? Or
I think so. They see this, and there's other companies working on these sort of things too, that see them as really, really compelling ways of telling stories in new ways. It's a journalistic endeavor, but it can also be used for things like advertising and for longer form films. This is just 10 minutes long, but as the technology improves, maybe there'll be more scope to tell longer stories and more inventive stories.
It does sound like maybe the future of kind of documentary filmmaking, you know, this appetite for being more and more within an experience, that VR might really lead the way.
Right, and especially in places like museums and exhibitions where people want to go and experience something. They might not have virtual reality at home yet, but when they go out to a show, maybe it's a new way of telling stories to them and telling them interesting new things. Also, this week, Google has a new logo, and it's round, which is very exciting.
Very round.
Very round. The new brand image of the company is a simplified, rounded typeface. It uses the same colours, but the serifs are gone. Not many companies would make headline news for changing their logos, but Google's a bit special. If you haven't seen it yet, go and Google it. You'll see it right there. The opinion on Twitter was predictably split. Some said the logo looked childish and frankly horrible, while others thought it was bolder and less stuck in the past. But podcast folk, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I find it very hard to get too worked up either way about a logo change.
Come on, Daniel. I want passion.
But to me, it looks like a cross between Lego and that kind of kids' alphabet spaghetti.
Alphabetti spaghetti.
Yes. And I don't know. It does. I probably, yeah, would lean more towards the slightly childish and amateur looking, I suppose.
Ouch. Cara?
Well, I think that they're doing something good by going away from serif. I think it was...
You're not a fan of serif.
I think it was a bold move. But no, I don't know what I'm saying.
See, I think crucially people are struggling to care too much about Google's new logo. But an awful lot of people did. And in Google's own words, which are quite marketing speaky, today we're introducing a new logo and identity family that reflects this reality and shows you when the Google magic is working for you.
Oh, see, that's...
It's lovely, isn't it? But I think, in all seriousness, the idea is to make the logo stand out more. So when you've got it in the little icon in the tab in your browser, it's way more recognisable, and it's way more recognisable.
It's very eye-catching.
It's eye-catching on smaller screens, bigger screens, and they're also using the same sort of colours and design aesthetics in their icons for apps. So it makes sense. I think Google's argument was that the old logo with the serifs was now really unrelated to most of its other design in its apps and Android, so that it brings it all back together again. So as logo news goes, this is big logo news.
Especially given, I think, you know, with Google, their big motto being don't be evil, there seems to be some kind of link that they're trying to soften it up or kind of make themselves appear a bit more, you know, innocuous and kind of easygoing. I don't know. Is there some kind of deeper meaning behind this logo facelift, perhaps?
Yes, almost certainly. I mean, they will have spent hundreds and hundreds of hours probably going over this. And we saw some pictures from Google's design board where they had all the other possible logos. Some of them were even more simplified to the point of just being a collection of shapes that broadly represented the word Google, which would have been interesting. But it seems like what they stuck with is something that's pretty typical of what a lot of companies are doing with their logo. It's flat, it's simpler, and it doesn't have serifs.
Well, I think like with any logo, it's just anything new, people are initially a bit resistant to change, but I'm sure it will kind of grow on a lot of the people who are slightly divided and might pave the way for other companies' future logos as well.
And with time, we'll all just come to ignore it and accept it for what it is. So, still to come, Michael sends us his hopes and dreams from the IFA Technology Show in Berlin. And as Barclays announces a contactless winter jacket, we ponder the most pointless technology we've ever used. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more, all with a simple integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For information and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Braintree can't wait to see what you make of it. Welcome back. Podcast host and serial funny man Michael Rundle is currently at the IFA Technology Show in Berlin. He's been going hands-on with Sony's new phones, Motorola's new watches, and new things from Samsung. Here's his breathless rundown of all the shiny things on show at one of the world's biggest technology trade fairs.
So greetings, podcast listeners from Wired's ultra-high-tech automated reporting workstation here at IFA 2015. The robot reporters are buzzing around me as we speak. The drones are capturing footage from all areas of the tech show, and the news is pouring in by our automated social media monitoring feeds as we speak. By which I mean, I'm in my hotel room, it's just gone midnight, and I'm recording this into my laptop. Still, it's all been worth it. It's been another year of big technology releases here at IFA 2015 in Berlin, mixed with some bizarre, gimmicky sideshows, a few desperate last stands by manufacturers on the edge, and pretty much everything in between. We've seen smart homes, smart watches, smart phones, and in one case, a smart rug, all jostling for position in between the products people might actually want to buy. I mean, the big story this year, predictably, is wearables. Smartwatches specifically, and on that score, we've seen a lot of big new releases. There's a new Moto 360, which comes with a variety of new materials and customization options, a controversial split between models aimed at women and models aimed at men. But that aside, some interesting new processors and hardware underneath the familiar round flat tire exterior. Samsung has also unveiled its new Gear S2, which has shocked onlookers by not being completely terrible, unlike every other wearable Samsung has ever released. The Gear S2, though, actually is worth a look. It's got a nice rotating bezel, some interesting notifications and widget options. And in terms of hardware, it actually is put together very nicely. It's a nice piece of design and good to see from Samsung. The Huawei watch also announced that this show has been covered on why.co.uk alongside a number of different wearables, and we'll have a full roundup at the end of the week. In terms of smartphones, IFA has traditionally been somewhere where Samsung and a few other manufacturers release some of their bigger handsets, though this year we've only seen one, the Sony Xperia Z5. Typically hard to say, and ultimately typically boring in terms of form factor. Most of the attention on the Xperia Z5 has focused on the premium model's larger, supposedly 4K display, supposedly world first, in fact, something hotly contested by other manufacturers who have released screens that are pretty much equivalent in terms of pixels per inch and every other metric you want to name long ago as a year ago. Outside that, though, we've seen some laptops, including Lenovo's Mix 700. If you see a picture of it, you might think it's a Microsoft Surface Pro, and you wouldn't be alone on that. It's very, very similar indeed. And we've also seen a lot of big talk again about the Internet of Things, the pitch being this year that you can actually buy some of the devices to turn your home into the equivalent of Fort Knox and Back to the Future and use them in real life. The pitch on the actual technology is largely the same. Monitor your family members, monitor your dog and your pets, maintain all of your locks and lights from half a world away, and ultimately turn into a domestic equivalent of 1984. But still, you can go to Currys and buy them, so that's exciting. As ever, though, some of the more interesting products have been found on the fringes of the big stands. Stuff like the smart mirror. Actually, that's part of Panasonic's stand, but it does give you the option not only of trying out makeup on your face before you apply it, but also trying out a number of facial hair designs. So we've all had fun attempting to give ourselves Hollywood moustaches while we should be interviewing people. One of the most genuinely interesting stories coming out of IFA has actually been from Wired's own Katie Collins, who used the inauspicious circumstances of a press conference by the security firm Kaspersky to turn herself into a cyborg. You can read about it on our site, but Katie essentially implanted a microchip into her hand, which can be reconfigured for a variety of different uses. In her piece, Katie actually admits that she doesn't know why she did this and doesn't even really know what the microchip is going to be able to do, but we're going to look forward to finding out in the future. So that aside, there's been a lot of interesting, weird, big news and strange, small, terrifying news here at IFA. But the big elephant in the room, and this is always the case at Berlin at this time of year, is Apple. As we know, Cupertino has a big event planned for next week where they're expected to unveil everything from the new iPhone to a new take on their Apple TV device. We're expecting a lot of big news, and all of the manufacturers really seem to have half an eye on what is happening in California as opposed to what's happening on their own booth. As we go into October and the run-up to Christmas, we're also going to see announcements from the likes of Google and Amazon and a lot of other big manufacturers until it gets to the end of October and Apple turn up again with their iPad announcement. At least we expect so. So that aside, IFA's been a pretty interesting show. Lots of big products, lots of strange products, lots of tired journalists, and me in a hotel room talking to you. Well, thanks for giving me 5 minutes of your time, James, and thanks for the intro. Though sorry there weren't too many jokes in this report. I'll try my hardest to get back on form when I'm in London next week. For now though, back to you in London.
Which leads us seamlessly to the most pointless piece of technology announced this week. Kara, not you. Not you. You can tell us about it.
Okay. So this week, Barclays and Lyle & Scott launched a contactless jacket.
Go on.
I think this idea has been around for a while. If you've ever been skiing, you'll probably know that ski jackets have pockets in the arm where you can put your pass. And so that's basically the idea here. There's a pocket in the right-hand cuff, which is perfectly sized for the BPay chip. So if you always wanted to pay for your coffee without taking your jacket off or your wallet out, you can now.
What does this thing actually look like? Is it stylish? Or I imagine it's kind of slightly clumpy and maybe not too nice to look at.
Well, they have it in two colours, blue and black, so it's very plain, only for men. So sorry, women. It just looks like a normal windbreaker, really.
It's lovely in every way. But essentially, this is just a jacket with a tiny, tiny, tiny little pocket on the sleeve into which you can put a tiny, tiny little debit card.
I see. I can't quite see the actual day-to-day uses. I'm not sure why you'd need that above and beyond a normal kind of contactless card, but hey.
Well, there you go. To explain BPAY to people that might not be familiar with it, this is Barclays contactless thing that it's going up against Apple Pay and Samsung Pay and things like this. And it's essentially a tiny little debit card that can be stuck to the back of your phone, or it can be put in a wristband, or now it can be put in the sleeve of a jacket.
Okay.
It means that essentially you don't have to take your wallet out of your pocket to pay for something contactlessly. And I wore a BPAY wristband for about 6 months around London to get around on the tube. And occasionally I'd use it to try and pay for drinks in a bar or something at a cafe. And it's confusing enough to try and tap your card on a reader when someone doesn't know that it's contactless, but to go, okay, I just need to put my wrist right here. And sometimes the reader doesn't quite reach, so you end up leaning awkwardly across the bar. So anyone that is persuaded to buy this, I think it's £120?
£150.
£150. So anyone that is persuaded to buy this £150 jacket might end up looking a bit silly.
And James, having worn the wristband, do you think you would possibly buy this? Or,
well, what I think I might do is buy the jacket and have one payment card in my right wrist and keep the wristband and have another payment card on my left wrist, so I can just pay for things at the same time in two different places and look really cool. Or not. Okay, so we were thinking, I mean, it's not necessarily a point, it's not really a point, a piece of technology. It's a jacket with a tiny pocket, but a lot of people will probably think it's a little silly. So that got us thinking about other silly pieces of technology. And I got you guys to come up with the most pointless piece of technology that you've ever owned.
Yes.
Daniel.
Well, this could be a bit controversial because I know people tend to either really love Kindles or not. But for me, my Kindle has pretty much been useless.
I am shocked.
I've had it for 2 years, and I think in that whole time I've used it about twice, and it's been kind of languishing at the bottom of my sock drawer ever since.
So this is the Kindle e-reader, not the Kindle tablet?
Yes, the Kindle reader. Basically, I don't know. There's just something about, I don't know, reading a physical book. I mean, we've heard all these arguments before, but I think sometimes it's quite nice to kind of almost escape staring at a screen. And every time I picked it up, I just found the whole thing a bit unwieldy, a bit clunky. The whole kind of percentage, you know, judging, measuring a book in a percentage of how much you've read.
It's always nice to get 26% for a book because you know that you've broken a quarter.
I suppose, yeah. I'm not giving it enough of a chance because I didn't even get that far with it. But I don't know. If it's not grown in me in 2 years, I'm starting to really wonder if I should just give it to the nearest charity shop or friend, maybe.
But do you still read normal books?
Well, this is the thing, yeah. I tend to read a lot of kind of paperbacks, but I just can't get used to putting my Kindle in my bag with me. And even though I travel, you know, commute on the tube, which I guess a lot of people use the Kindle for that, it's just not taken.
This is good to hear because I have been mocked consistently for being the person that has carried 6 books around South America with her rather than taking a Kindle with me. So I
guess
completely
for holidays,
agree.
I could understand the argument where if you're traveling and going on holiday, you don't want to be carrying around a suitcase full of books. But
you do tend to see less and less Kindles on public transport now, on buses and trains and the tube, than you did a little while ago. So maybe a lot of people got them, like, yeah, I've got a Kindle. I'm the same. I've got one. But now I've sort of gone back to some paperback books that I picked up a few months ago and haven't put down. And I also quite like nosying at what people are reading, right?
Yes.
And with a Kindle, everyone's just advertising Amazon.
And you don't have to worry about getting it a bit dirty or you spill your tea on it. You know, these are just very simple things. But, you know, with a Kindle, you just can't do it.
But maybe it's the ideal way to read 50 Shades of Grey and not have anyone know that you're reading it. So maybe all the Kindles will come out again when E.L. James chucks out her next.
Perish the thought.
Exactly. Cara, what's your most pointless piece of technology?
So for Christmas a few years ago, my mom gave me a digital photo frame.
That's very nice.
It is very nice of her. But I've never really understood the point because, well, I don't really put pictures around my bedroom as it is. And now we all have iPads and phones and computers, so you've got your photos on there. I don't really need pictures of my friends and family just staring at me.
Glowing in the corner of the room.
Flicking through as I tried to go to sleep.
Right, yeah. Well, a lot of people had these. They were very, very popular stocking fillers, I suppose, a few years ago, weren't they? But maybe they didn't have much of a shelf life.
I think they're in the realm of the sort of digital pictures, as in like works of art that you see in some restaurants and things, which I think are always just a bit...
We have the screens with the fake log fire and these kind of, yeah.
Oh, they're lovely. See, I can see the advantage of them because you get a photo, you put it on your wall, and then maybe you don't like that photo anymore. But you don't want to print another one. Whereas if you've got a digital one, you can just click a button and ta-da, you can have a new photo and change it every day. You don't have to do the slideshowy sort of thing. So maybe people are giving digital photo frames a bad rap.
Even digital cameras, I guess, have almost been phased out. I mean, I have a digital camera that I've not used in years because I've got so used to taking photos on smartphones. So it's funny, just in a short space of time, these things can really change.
It's either a smartphone or a DSLR.
Yeah,
seemingly, or a retro camera with an actual film.
Yeah.
Okay, mine is going to take a little bit more explaining. It's called Carrots, and it's an adorable interactive smart bunny rabbit.
Do tell.
I got given two of these little things a couple of years ago, and they became little more than elaborate, slightly ugly desk ornaments. So allow me to explain. Also known as, I'm probably going to say this slightly wrong, Nabaztag, which is Armenian for hair, Carrots is a Wi-Fi-enabled rabbit look-alike-y thing that can download weather forecasts, emails, and it glows different colours and wiggles its ears accordingly to let you know that you've got a notification.
How big is this thing?
It's about the size of a bunny rabbit. And it's white, and baffled. It's made of plastic, and yeah, its ears move and its belly glows.
And so it downloads weather reports and the such like, and then what does it do with them?
So it can speak to you in, it's a French invention, it can speak to you in French or English. It can read out news headlines, it can act as an alarm clock, it can read RSS feeds. It can pretty much do anything that you can feed into it. And it was really customizable, so you could play around with it and add loads of new features and hacks. And so in that respect, it was kind of cool, and it did everything in its slightly eccentric, glowy, ear-wiggly way, which was charming, but also quite annoying.
So did you ever use it for anything?
Well, it took me quite a while to get it set up, which was fairly fiddly to begin with, and then it felt fairly useless. Cute, but useless.
It sounds more like a kind of something kids would like, a kind of kids toy. But
no, you wouldn't want to give it to kids.
No.
The kids wouldn't.
Smash
it would be this. Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, one of them did end up with its head ripped off after a little while. Someone got a bit bored of looking at it. But it's so complicated to set up. And once you get it set up, it doesn't really do anything that a smartphone can't. Kind of looks cool, has wiggly ears, but
speaks French and is Armenian. I mean, it's just truly bizarre.
It was lovely. And I've still got one somewhere. When I moved house, I bought it with me just in case I ever wanted it again. It's languishing somewhere in a dusty box. So that's the Carrots. But what about everyone out there in podcast land, as I'm now going to call it? What's your most pointless piece of technology? Let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. Getting on to your letters, emails, complaints and tweets. Unfortunately, I don't have access to the Wired UK podcast inbox. So if you have emailed us this week, we'll pick it up when Michael returns from the land of beer and sausages next week and read them out then. But we have one paltry joke from Twitter. So saving us from feeling unloved is Twitter user Daryl Changstein, who is at I am not a twit, with this corker. Daniel, would you like to read it?
I shall do the honour. So if at first you don't succeed, call it version 1.0.
Get it?
No.
No. he did say he stole it from the internet. It's a fairly old and well-known joke. So the idea being that you shouldn't really have to explain a joke. So maybe this isn't funny. But never mind. There you go. You laughed at that. So there we are. Next week, Michael and Katie will be back on the show and we'll be finding out more about what they saw at IFA, because there is just so many things to see at IFA. But for now, that's all we've got time for this week. We'll see you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.